Blog Talk Radio. Listening to the Words on Flick show on eWater Radio, KEWRDB. Welcome to the Words on Flick from a fan perspective with yours truly, entertainment journalist, blogger, and movie fan, Janine Coveney. That's me. Hey, y'all, it's March, which means it's Women's History Month. This also includes International Women's Day, which is tomorrow, March 8th. And by the way, the ride service Lyft is offering discounts for the rest of the month in several major cities to women-owned businesses and places that honor the contributions of women, such as museums and other cultural institutions and monuments. I guess that doesn't include movie theaters, but that's okay. Women's History Month has been celebrated since 1987 and a lot of places before that, but that's the year the government recognized it as a national holiday. And Women's Month has usually been commemorated with some sort of presidential proclamation, but I wouldn't hold my breath this year. So because it's Women's Month, I wanted to talk a little bit, well, a lot of it, actually, about the role of women in film, particularly how they're portrayed, the type of stories that surround women, because we know that film is a very key reflection of what's going on in the culture and society of the time. And as much as film reflects what's going on, it also influences what's going on with us in terms of what's accepted, what we think about, the change we want to make, and how we comport ourselves. So obviously this is a very big topic. So my disclaimer here is that no, I will not be getting through an in-depth and complete detailed history or, detailed survey of women in film within this one show. But there were a few films I wanted to talk about, mention as I go along. So if you have some favorites, some women-centered favorites that I don't mention tonight, make sure to let me know and we can continue the conversation through other Words on Flick shows during the month. So I just wanted to say that obviously I'm a woman, but I grew up in New York City and I'm a product of single sex education that is girls only, women only, from middle school to high school and on through college. So from a young age, I was educated with the idea that women are powerful and smart and capable and can do anything we set our minds to and should do whatever we want in terms of career, personal fulfillment, personal relationships, and determining rights to our own bodies. So this idea has always been important to me, and I've always been aware of how women are portrayed and treated in film as well, in narratives. So, but there's no getting around the fact that historically our society has struggled to come to terms with gender roles and gender, and this has certainly played out in the images of women and the roles of that female actresses have been given to play on screen. And so this isn't even getting into the topic of what goes on behind the camera, where roles, you know, on the crew were once defined by gender. You found very few women who weren't costumers or makeup artists, hair people on the set. And the script girl was a standard job. So, and to date, there's still been only one woman, I believe, to win Best Director at the Oscars in the major competitive categories, and that was Kathryn Bigelow for The Hurt Locker a few years back. So according to Women and Hollywood, which is an organization that educates, advocates, and agitates for gender diversity and inclusion in the film industry, there were 40 of 2018's 100 top grossing films that were led or co-led by women, that is, in the storytelling, while only 4.3% of the top 1,200 films between 2017 and 2018 were directed by women. So that's significant. I recommend that website if you're interested in women and their role in Hollywood in front of the screen or behind the screen. Check out womenandhollywood.com. They keep a running tally of films about women, films directed by women, and opportunities for women in the industry, which I think is very important in this day. But we did see that at this year's Oscar ceremony, 15 women received Oscars, which is, I believe, the most to date to be awarded at the Oscars. So, yay for that. So in Hollywood screen narratives from the past, we know that women have been used as sexual window dressing, sexual props, sexual bait, and the butt of jokes. You know, make that a big butt and big boobs. And that's always been true. We know that sex sells and gender roles were very strictly defined. So, you know, from the 1920s on, we had these depictions of women as femme fatales, you know, the sirens who lead men to their doom. They tempt them. They pull them off track, men being the heroes. I'm trying to say heroine, but I mean the heroes of these films. They, in order to fulfill their mission or fulfill their life's dreams, they have to keep women at a distance. And then with the screwball comedies of the 1930s and 40s came the idea that women were often dizzy and illogical, you know, crazy, liable to lead sensible men down a path to, if not doom, then certainly uncomfortable complications, for sure. And as the old Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince rap song once said, you know, Hollywood thought girls ain't nothing but trouble. That's right. But by the 1940s, there's a concerted effort to create films that cater to Hollywood's biggest audience demographic, which is women, and particularly as World War II came to a close and more women were in the workforce, there was an effort to depict their lives and their issues. And this brought about the film genre called the woman's film in the 1940s. So according to Wikipedia, with that font of, you know, implacable wisdom, unimpeachable wisdom, but, you know, allow me to quote it here. The women's film is a film genre which includes women-centered narratives, female protagonists, and is designed to appeal to a female audience. Duh. Okay. So women's films usually portray quote-unquote women's concerns, such as problems revolving around domestic life, the family, motherhood, self-sacrifice, and, of course, romance. So a lot of these films were produced from the silent era through the 1950s and early 1960s, but were most popular in the 1930s and the 1940s, reaching their zenith during World War II, as I mentioned earlier. So although Hollywood continued to make films characterized by some of the elements of the traditional women's film, in the second half of the 20th century, the term itself disappeared in the 1960s. But the work of directors George Cukor, Douglas Sirk, Max Ophuls, and Joseph von Sternberg have been associated with the women's film genre. And of course, Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, and Barbara Stanwyck were some of the genre's most prolific stars. So if you are a major fan of classic film, you're probably familiar with a lot of these movies and these particular stars, a lot of black and white films, of course. And many of these classic women's films were, you know, synonymous with melodrama. You know, melodrama are dramatic narratives focusing on social conflicts with exaggerated emotions, and they kind of tug on you, and there are dramatic complications and hand-wringing and tears and dramatic reunions and things like that. And I was personally raised on a lot of these classic melodramas and women's pictures, you know, watching movies after school, the Million Dollar Movie, the 4:30 movie on ABC. A lot of these older films were the staple of, you know, nighttime and weekend viewing for a lot of local channels. So Joan Crawford and Mildred Pierce has got to be the pinnacle of that woman's film, right? So if you haven't seen Mildred Pierce, I don't think I'll be giving you any spoilers. It's a well-known film. If you haven't seen it, you should check it out because it is super dramatic, and it is one of Joan Crawford's best performances on film. I'm sure some people would want to argue with me about that because she certainly made a lot of films during the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But Mildred Pierce is a film from 1945 directed by Michael Curtiz. It's an essential film because it shows what the society thought about a strong female central character whose choices to stand on her own two feet after her first marriage fails has devastating consequences. So she marries a man and, you know, they're poor, but they don't have, you know, they don't have a lot of money, but they're making it. And she has two girls. And then her husband decides that he's in love with another woman, and he leaves the daughters. And it's the classic tale of a woman who is forced by circumstance to work hard to make a living, but she can only advance with the help of men. And most of these men want something in return. They want a little romance, a little love. And so poor Mildred Pierce is faced with making these decisions because she wants to get ahead and secure a future for herself. But in the process, her oldest daughter, Vita, becomes spoiled and competitive. So at first, Mildred, when her husband first leaves, she has to take a job in a hash house. And she tries to keep it from her daughter because she wants her daughter to be raised with the finer things. Here's a audio clip from Mildred Pierce.
If you bought the uniform for Lottie, and I certainly can't imagine who else you could have bought it for, then why shouldn't she wear it?
You've been snooping around ever since I got this job, trying to find out what it is. So now you know. You know, don't you?
Know what? Know what, Mother?
You knew when you gave that uniform to Lottie that it was mine, didn't you?
Your uniform?
Yes, I'm waiting tables in a downtown restaurant.
My mother.
I took the only job I could get so you and your sister could eat and have a place to sleep and some clothes on your back.
Aren't the pies bad enough? Did you have to be greater?
Vita, don't talk like that.
I'm really not surprised.
You've never spoken of your people, who you came from, so perhaps it's natural. Maybe that's why, Father... sorry I did that. I'd have rather cut off my hands. I'd never have taken the job if I hadn't wanted to keep us all together. Besides, I wanted to learn the business the best way possible.
What kind of business?
The restaurant business. I'm planning on opening a place of my own. There's money in a restaurant if it's run right.
You mean we'll be rich?
You mean we'll be rich? Anyway, sorry for the audio quality, but the point is that Mildred has been hiding her uniform as a waitress, and her snotty daughter gives it to the maid, Butterfly McQueen, to wear, knowing full well that it's her mother's uniform. Anyway, this kind of portrait of strong women who don't depend on men and shoulder work responsibility started to emerge after World War II. Many of the stories show the issues women face in a male-dominated world, but also the sacrifices when women choose work or general independence over love or a personal life, or even over motherhood. And this is a continuing theme, I think even through today. Can women have it all? But Mildred Pierce is also distinct because it kind of starts as this kind of domestic melodrama, but morphs into a psychological thriller because of the escalating tension between Mildred and her now teenage daughter, Vita, who disdains her mother's working class origins and sets out to steal her mother's beau. So the conflict ends in murder with Vita shooting Mildred's new husband, Monty, who's no good anyway, because he's romancing both ladies. So now Mildred tries to shield the ungrateful daughter from the police by lying about the murder. So anyway, there's always a price to pay as a woman in society, is what the film says. Mildred is punished for her efforts to lead her own life as a woman, independent, looking for love, and as a woman independent, starting her own business. So there's a price to pay for that. Then there are those movies where the female protagonist suffers because of who she falls in love with. In these pictures, it seems that people are, you know, you're struck by love, you fall in love, you have no free will in the matter. You know, you look at this person and they're the one for you, and it doesn't matter if they're from the wrong side of the tracks or if they're above your station or below your station or whatever it is. These women fall and they'll go to any lengths to remain true despite all obstacles, no matter what it costs them. And we're supposed to admire them for it because that's who women are. Women are steadfast. Women are loyal. Women are devoted. These are the qualities that are associated with femininity during these times, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, up to today. So as concerns the women's picture genre, Betty Davis had quite a few of these types of pictures, and of course there's no way I can delineate them all, but recently I saw 1942's Now Voyager, where she plays a upper crust woman from Boston whose main problem is that she lives under the thumb of a domineering mother. She's single, everyone else has been married, she's saddled with the care of her mother who's ailing but still dominates her. And she's seen as homely and unlovable, which is something that her mother kind of reiterates and makes her believe until she becomes unstable. But as soon as her character comes under the care of a kindly doctor, she gets her mental thing together, and then she plucks her eyebrows and fixes her hair and becomes chic enough for a sexy married doctor, played by European smoothie Paul Henry, to find her attractive on a cruise. So this young woman sacrifices herself to this unconsummated love affair by devoting herself to the man's young daughter, who has emotional issues that she herself overcame. So, you know, at the end of the picture, why should we have the moon and stars? She said, you know, says to her lover, or actually, I'm getting it wrong. Why should we ask for the sun and moon? We have the stars, or whatever it is. You know, we have just enough love. We'll never be able to be together, but we can love each other from afar. She sacrificed herself. So she sacrificed herself again, and I'm talking about Bette Davis, in the film All, I believe it's called All That Heaven Allows. Should have checked that. It's a costume period drama from 1700s France, and it's based on a true story. In this film, Bette Davis is a young governess to a respected duke and his obsessive wife, the Duke and Duchess de Bralon. It's very French. The Duchess is kind of, she's an indifferent mother, she's an obsessive wife, and she's lost the love of her husband because of her dramatics and her ill will. So, of course, the children and the Duke, who's again played by Paul Henreid, they fall in love with the governess because, you know, she's steadfast, she's true, she's loving, but she never succumbs to the affair. She never allows herself to be physical with the Duke. But when the jealous Duchess dies, she frames the governess for her death. And even with Bette Davis being, you know, accused and dragged off to prison and undergoing a trial, she holds her head high. And this is the lesson that contemporary women are supposed to take from this. You remain pure, you remain loyal and true, you have fidelity, but somehow you are unsullied and virginal to the end, I guess. So women's pictures were also the domain of actress-turned-director Ida Lupino, who starred in dozens of films from this period, but she also turned into a director and producer and churned out, you know, a whole bunch of so-called women's pictures in the 1950s. And she was the only female filmmaker working in Hollywood at the time. And she specialized in creating films about unwed motherhood, rape, bigamy, mental illness, and she was the first woman to direct a film noir, The Hitchhikers. I would look her up, Ida Lupino. She was an attractive woman, and she was no joke because she had to fight the Hollywood system to get these pictures made, and they were well received. They were, you know, they might not have been Hollywood blockbusters, but she made a lot of money for those studios. Otherwise, they wouldn't have let her continue to make these pictures that spoke to a lot of things that women were dealing with. Now, certainly film narratives are all about the choices that the main protagonist makes, for good or for ill. But for these women's pictures, their gender and the expectations surrounding their roles as women in society played a part in their destiny in a way that does not affect men in these stories. The things that happen to men in movies are not because they're men. You know, the things that happen to women are because they are women. So moving on to the swinging 60s, you know, now you have more counterculture of films starting to come into vogue. The strict roles about women, what women can and cannot do in society, are beginning to loosen a little bit as the hemlines, you know, get shorter and shorter. And it has to do with the beginnings of the sexual revolution and the free love movement, the music that's coming out, the British invasion, music change, rock starting to change, rock and roll, you know, getting, you know, coming in and challenging some of the old school crooners. And as the music changes, so does the dress and the attitudes and things like that. So, but those old stereotypes and lessons of how women should be die hard, because you have a picture like 1966's Georgie Girl, in which a British girl played by Lynn Redgrave, who is seen as a plain Jane, she struggles to find love and acceptance in mod swinging London. And so within the film, we get a cautionary tale when her party girl roommate, played by Charlotte Rampling, turns up pregnant, then abandons the baby to Georgie's care. And let me tell you, Charlotte Rampling is She is so unpleasant in this movie. I mean, she's gorgeous. She's still gorgeous. But she's such a brat. You know, she gets pregnant and she has not a maternal bone in her body. And so as soon as she has the baby, she, you know, goes off with another man, not the baby's father, to continue her lifestyle of, you know, partying around London. And what ends up happening is the baby's father and Georgie fall into an affair as they're caring for this baby. But the relationship doesn't last because she's more interested in the baby. And when she finds out that the baby could be taken away from her because she's not a legal guardian, she, you know, accepts marriage from an older suitor, a man who's been pursuing her for a while with a proposition to be his mistress. And he's played by one of my favorite English actors, James Mason. So he's been pursuing her all along. And so, you know, she gives in. And at the end of the movie, you know, they're coming from the wedding and everybody's throwing rice and he's deliriously happy. But she's just holding the baby. She's just interested in the baby. And so the film seems to say, yes, women have choices, but not all of them guarantee happiness. You know, you can choose to be a single mother, you can choose to be a party girl, you can choose to be a wife, but are all of these compromises? Are these the only roles that women can choose? So on the opposite end of the spectrum in the 1960s, you have French director Roger Vadim, who brought to screen a French comic book story that showcases a sexy, futuristic astronaut in 1968's Barbarella. So in this story, in the 41st century, sex is deemed to be so matter-of-fact to earthlings that it's accomplished by taking pills. If you want to have sex with somebody, you take a couple of pills, you hold your hands together, that's it. So during her mission to find a mad scientist, Duran Duran, Barbarella is easily convinced to have sex the old-fashioned way without batting an eyelash or needing romantic attachments. And people saw that, you know, moviegoers thought that was either really interesting or really trashy. The movie did not get rapturous reviews in the time that it came out, but it's become a cult film, certainly. It's funny, it's amusing, it's quaint, and Jane Fonda looks sexy. But Barbarella is not supposed to be a femme fatale in the story. She's supposed to be a free spirit. She's not luring men to their doom. She's just kind of like this wide-eyed naive wandering around this planet in these eye-popping outfits trying to achieve her mission. So while the film has reached cult status, it was excoriated for its weak storytelling and its lurid imagery and its objectification of the title character. But then also during the 60s, Fonda played the lead character in a Western musical comedy called Cat Ballou, which is the name of the title character, about a young woman who comes to a Western town to help defend her father's ranch and become a school teacher. So she's gone to finishing school. She's a proper young lady. It's the 1800s, and now she's going to be a school teacher. But then she gets caught up in this deadly game of revenge when her father's killed, and she ends up turning into an outlaw herself. So now she's the legend of Cat Ballou, trying to gain justice and get rid of the bad guys. And the movie is kind of told for laughs. It's a musical, and there's some funny bits in it. But the original source material from which it was derived was straightforward. It was serious. It was a serious tale of a young woman who, you know, defies stereotypes and puts aside her long skirts and her teacher garb to put on chaps and pick up a gun and try to make things happen and fight for rights. So could it be that such a serious female character in the Old West was thought to be too much for the audience's sensibilities at that time? Could be. It's an odd movie. I've seen it a few times. It's not, I wouldn't call it a great musical. And then Nat King Cole shows up at the beginning, strolling around in the Western town, singing the title song. And it's like he's the only African-American person in the film. Like, he doesn't fit. Anyway, as we get into the 1970s, there's also numerous films about women becoming self-aware and taking back their power from male institutions. So certainly this is seen in the Blaxploitation era, of which Pam Grier was the undisputed queen. What can you say about Pam? She was beautiful and formidable, and in movie after movie of this period, she decides to take things into her own hands. She rights wrongs. She avenges deaths. She avenges, drug infiltration into her neighborhood. She defends family members who have been targeted by gangs or pimps or other malfeasance. And, you know, she doesn't need anybody's help. Here's a clip from Foxy Brown, and I hope you can hear it. It's only a short clip because there's a lot of cussing in it, and I didn't want to expose listeners here. We're keeping it clean. But here's a little clip from Foxy Brown with Antonio Fargas playing her brother.
What are you trying to do? Kill me!
I damn well ought to, you rotten bastard! And if I don't, you better thank the Lord you're my brother, because there's no other reason.
Oh, baby, look, let me alone! I didn't do nothing to you!
You know damn well what you did! Now I'm not going to stand here and argue with you. Now you better tell me who you talked to, because it's either them or you.
I swear, baby, I don't know what you're talking about.
Now I only got so much control, and I'm liable to put one of these right between your eyes, no matter what Mama say.
Baby, look, all I know is what I hear.
I want the name, Link, the name.
All right.
Okay, that's a short clip, and it was probably hard to hear, but she's confronting her own brother and trying to get information about who's running drugs in the neighborhood. But I find it interesting because she's got a gun in her hand and she's shooting at her own brother. You know, and she's like, look, I might not have any control of this gun, so you better start talking. And as soon as he says, oh, I don't know anything, she lets a bullet fly. And I'm like, she's willing to shoot her own brother. So imagine the kind of, havoc she's going to wreak on the people that she doesn't like and is not related to. And at the end of that scene, not only does she get all the information that she wants from her brother, she then trashes the apartment. She like breaks things, throws everything around, and it's like, you're getting out of town, and he does it. That's what he does. So yeah, Pam Grier's characters, she has nerves of steel. She's not afraid to use her sexuality as a weapon. She doesn't need any help, although she'll accept it if it's offered. And it's clear that she doesn't need a man, but she chooses love when she wants it. So Pam's films include Coffee, Foxy Brown, Sheba Baby, and more. And these type of films, and there were others, and other female action stars and Blaxploitation stars. And of course, later she was in Jackie Brown in 1997, in which she also does what she has to do. She doesn't sling a gun quite as readily, but it's the same idea. And just by the way, there's a great brand new video interview with Pam Grier out today on TheRoot.com, where she shares commentary about her film career, and you should definitely check it out. It's on TheRoot.com. It just came out today. And she's getting ready to star in another movie called Palm. Maybe I'll talk to you a little bit about it in a future edition of Words on Flicks, because it is a women's picture. Okay, but we're in the 70s. So the flip side of this is Mahogany, where star Diana Ross plays Tracy, who rises up from the hood in Chicago to become a top international model and then a fashion designer. But she gets taken down a peg when she realizes that all of this, all of this wild partying and high life and success in a foreign country, never mind that she's over in Europe and probably feeling isolated and a little weird, but she realizes that she really needs her man, the Chicago community organizer played by Billy Dee Williams. And what he told her from the start, she realizes is true. Love is nothing without someone to share it with. Another choice that women have to make. Career, love, can women have it all? The theme seems to continue. As the 70s come to a close, then you have another actress who really seemed to embody the sensibilities of the time, 70s going into the early 80s. And this is Jill Clayburgh, who's a fabulous actress, and we miss her. And she seemed to play the quintessential every woman, or the woman that women wanted to be. She's smart, she's urbane, she's sexy, and now she's finding out that it's okay to be single or okay to be in a relationship whose terms she defines. That type of story is best defined by 1978's An Unmarried Woman, in which her life as an Upper East Side wife and mother is totally upended when her husband decides he doesn't want to be married anymore and leaves her for a younger woman, throwing her life into chaos. And while this is a woman's story, I find the promotion for it interesting because it's marketed as Paul Mazursky's An Unmarried Woman, and certainly he directed it. But the fact that his name is so prominent in it is telling, I would say. So here's a clip, and again, I hope the audio is okay. It's the preview, the trailer for An Unmarried Woman, and you get the whole story in this little clip of it here.
This is Erica Benton, a lovable wife. A wonderful mother. She's uninhibited, unpredictable.
You're not getting enough.
Unshakable.
You think you ought to have your eyes examined.
And unprepared.
What? Tell me.
I'm in love with somebody else. At first, I thought it was just a thing. But it isn't. I'm in love with her.
20th Century Fox presents Paul Mazursky's An Unmarried Woman.
What are you doing out by yourself?
Getting divorced.
What happened?
He was buying a shirt in Bloomingdale's and he fell in love. I'm sad, I'm lonely.
It's certainly okay to feel lonely. It's really okay to feel anything. Anger.
You really hate me, don't you?
Yeah. Depression.
It's over, kiddo. Good.
Are you seeing other men yet?
No.
Oh, God, dating. Silly word. I'd risk it. I'd risk it with some new men.
Men, huh? Why did you move closer to me?
I don't know. I guess I want to be closer
don't
to you.
Don't, Bob. I'm afraid.
I am what I am. I make no bones about it.
Charlie, I'm very nervous. Your talking is just making me more nervous.
So I don't know if you could hear that, but it's the 360 degrees of emotion when she finds herself single, single and free. She's the mother of a young teenager, and she cries to her teenager, "Hey, it's, you know, the relationship is over. Your father and I are not getting back together." And then she has to figure out dating again. Who does she want to date? Does she want to date? And now, after being married for 17 years, she's got to figure out her life and who she wants to be with and who she wants to be. So the movie was kind of a landmark, even though a lot of people in society had already gone through these kinds of things. It's a classic joke that, you know, men always fall for the younger woman, and what's the older woman to do once the husband leaves? And this was one of the first films to really show that in a modern context and allow a woman her sexuality to choose and not be bound by traditional roles, because she does date around and have sex with different people. And at the end of that clip, you hear her, you know, her talking to this guy, they're going to bed, and he's talking, and she's, you know, half dressed, and she's like, "You're making me nervous." So anyway, Paul Mazursky's An Unmarried Woman. But as divorce became more and more commonplace, with people trying to find themselves and try out alternative lifestyles, during the 70s, so both men and women were calling it quits in equal numbers and leaving marriage behind and trying to reinvent their lives. So Jill Clayburgh shows up again with Candace Bergen as Burt Reynolds tries to get his life together after divorce and starting over. And, you know, it's a charming little movie, except that I find it hard to accept Burt Reynolds, who is always portrayed as this virile, handsome, outgoing, get any woman he wants type of guy in the 70s. And here he's playing kind of a low-key, introspective, kind of doubting guy, insecure guy named, I think his character's name is Phil Potter. Like, really? Burt Reynolds does not look like a Phil Potter. Anyway, I digress. So another strain of films starring women shows them as firsts in their field or overcoming huge odds to succeed in their quests for justice or recognition. And we might call these, I don't know, heroine films, you know. You've got your films like Norma Rae with Sally Field, who is struggling to be part of the union movement. She works in a factory, and she gets swept up. You know, she's got children, she's got lovers, but she connects with this union organizer. And then you have Silkwood with Meryl Streep, which is a story about a real-life woman working in, well, you'll hear more about it. The biopic Heart Like a Wheel in 1983 with Bonnie Bedelia portraying drag race driver Shirley Muldowney, who was a first. And even some more contemporary heroine stories like Erin Brockovich with Julia Roberts. These women are caught in the middle of a moment in history, and some actually pay for their success with being ostracized, losing their status, or even in some cases losing their lives, in the case of Karen Silkwood. In the book, Reeling Through Life, How I Learned to Live, Love, and Die at the Movies, from Soft Skull Press, 2015, author Tara Eisen writes extensively about the movies that influenced and impacted her as she grew up in Southern California. In the chapter, How to Be a Slut, which is a title I love, she writes about being single and childless in real life, but looking to the movies that she loves, for a reflection of her life choices. But she's seen depictions of women who are kind of nobler than thou, and many of these mothers manage to be, many of these women manage to be mothers as well. So she writes, and let's see if I can find it. Well, there are the heroines, often based on extraordinary real-life women who dedicate themselves to a big purpose, capital B, capital P. Erin of Erin Brockovich takes on the corrupt Pacific Gas and Electric in order to seek justice for a poisoned, powerless community. Norma Ray of Norma Ray risks death in order to unionize her textile mill. Karen Silkwood will actually die trying to speak truth to power in Silkwood. I see all these movies and am inspired by their lead characters' commitment and bravery. These are the pure and high-minded women who will risk everything to change the world for the better. I am also glad to see the men in their lives take a back seat as supporting characters. They might grumble about the trouble their leading lady women are getting themselves into, but they will also take care of the kids while the women are doing so. And there you go. These women are also mothers, motivated in part by the selfless desire to improve their own children's lives. I admire these women. But I am no heroine. I wimp out at the slightest hint of jeopardy. I don't even have the energy to take on the evil conglomerates of the world. And without children, any positive impact I might seek to make or legacy I might leave behind is abstract, theoretical. So, and there ends that reading. But Tara Eisen, who I respect greatly, she was actually one of my instructors when I got my MFA at Antioch University, and I came across this book because I wanted to write a similar book about how individual movies impacted my growing up, which isn't to say that I can't still write something like that, but I thought, oh, she's already done it, and it's done so well. So again, that's called Reeling Through Life, How I Learned to Live, Love, and Die at the Movies. And talking about how the choices that we make personally, we can look on screen and either get confirmation or contradiction in these times where women can be everything and do everything, it seems. And that certainly is true as the 80s get fully underway with the whole Me decade and the boom of Wall Street and, you know, high fashion and supermodels and the music is, you know, MTV culture. And, of course, the women's equality movement having supposedly reached, you know, its goals in putting women into the boardroom and not just at their desks outside the offices of their bosses, and as they're shown in 9 to 5 with Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Dolly Parton. So now we're seeing depictions of hard-nosed businesswomen having to make the choice between love and career, between family and career, and redefining all over again what it is to be a woman. There's that question one more time. Can women have it all? So we see films like Baby Boom, a comedy. Of course, it's a comedy because all of this soul-searching is hysterically funny. Diane Keaton is a successful ad executive with a smart live-in boyfriend and a very no-nonsense lifestyle until she literally inherits her late cousin's baby child and has to completely rearrange her life. So this is a movie that says that at her core, every woman has a natural maternal instinct, which is what Tara Eisen was questioning. And every woman at her core has to have a man or be in a relationship to be truly happy and to be truly successful. Okay. So another one of my favorite comedies from this era is Working Girl from 1988, where now the message is that the idea of having it all is not just for the upper crust wealthy girls represented by Sigourney Weaver, but any girl, a girl from the sticks of Staten Island with a New York accent and, you know, some kind of ethnic roots, played by Melanie Griffith. and someone we can all identify with. You know, whatever your background, she's a regular girl. So she can also pull herself up by her bootstraps on smarts alone and make it in the hard scrabble halls of business, New York's Wall Street. Process, she can, you know, she can snare Harrison Ford as a love interest. This movie is about the fact that class as well as gender are barriers to be overcome. And also it shows that other women can now be our adversaries in the fight to define ourselves and set our own independence. Now we have to fight against other women and their quest for success, and now it becomes competitive. Not just can we have it all, but who do we snatch it all from? So, yes, movies have been saying more and more since the late 60s and early 70s about having anything they want and being anything they want to be. And one of the things they want to be or can be is just as hard as the men. So the film Thelma and Louise in 1991 ably demonstrated that when pushed to their limits by the abuses of men, the rule of thumb is now cherchez la femme, beware a woman's scorn. Thelma and Louise was considered a breakthrough, though an extremely controversial one at the time, because of its depiction of women as free agents and they're willing to defy the laws of society and the law itself. You know, marriage can't hold them. You know, expectations can't hold them. Society and the law are two institutions that did little to protect these characters from neglect, harassment, bias, violence, and most importantly, rape. And so the choices that they make to escape this, you know, Thelma and Louise start out on a little car trip, you know, a little road trip with the girls, and it escalates as things go very wrong for them. And, you know, the ending of Thelma and Louise actually shocked a lot of people, as it was the embodiment of the idea of live free or die. Which is a state motto. These women did not want to go to prison. They did not want to be separated. They did not want to be returned to a life of drudgery. So they exited stage left into the Grand Canyon, but it was within their power to choose how they wanted their story to end. And so I think for a lot of people, that was shocking. So certainly as I'm getting to the end of the show tonight, I could talk a whole lot more about all the badass women who came in the wake of Thelma and Louise and Luc Besson's 1990 French film La Femme Nikita, and a whole bunch of roles by Charlize Theron and Angelina Jolie, but I'm only going to scratch the surface here, and certainly I'll talk about more about these type of roles in a future show. I wanted to end tonight to remind you that in 2019, this weekend, we have a screen version of Captain Marvel, an American superhero film based on the Marvel Comics character Carol Danvers. So set in 1995, the story follows Danvers as she becomes Captain Marvel after the Earth is caught in the center of a galactic conflict between two alien worlds. So this is actually Marvel Comics' first superhero film to be led by a woman and stars Brie Larson as Captain Marvel. The story is adapted from a comic titled The Kree-Skrull War, where Kree is a planet that her character is from, and she inadvertently lands on Earth as part of the battle. And here, Brie Larson talks just a little bit about her character's motivation and what it was like to put on the suit for the first time and what it's like to be a female superhero.
initially it was just like the origin story of who she is, the fact that she's part Cree, part human, and the way that that metaphor kind of plays into it, I think, is a very human experience. The Cree part being the logical part of her, the part that's using her brain, and then the human part of her, which is, I don't know, I guess more illogical, the intuition part of her, her heart. A huge part of this movie is her making judgment calls of, do you do the logical thing or do you do the thing that feels right? And I think that that's a huge part of our day-to-day experience. I mean, sure, I feel like any time's a good time for a female superhero. So if it's going to happen now, sure, we'll do it.
Hey, why not have a female superhero? There was a lot of success for the film about, the Amazon woman. Okay, it'll come back. Diana Prince, you know who I'm talking about. Wonder Woman. How could I forget Wonder Woman? So now we have a Captain Marvel that's a female in another universe, and I think that's great. Captain Marvel opens this weekend. So I suggest you check it out, if only to support International Women's Day, Women's History Month, and the Marvel Universe's first female superhero. And not to mention that Samuel L. Jackson is in it, and, you know, he's a national treasure. It also features Jude Law, Annette Bening, and Clark Gregg, and others. So you should definitely check out Captain Marvel this weekend. That's the popcorn pick for Words on Flicks. So, as I promised, I will talk more about women in film as the month goes on, Women's History Month. I want to thank you for joining me for the Words on Flicks show with me, Janine Coveney. This is E-Water Radio, K-E-W-R-D-B. And I hope that you have a blessed and safe week. It is March, and hopefully we'll be looking at spring soon. But it seems like March has come in like a lion, because on the East Coast, it's a little bit chilly, but we shall survive. So I'll see you here for the Words on Flick show again next week. Enjoy with movies, as in life. Keep watching and keep watching out. Be safe. All right? See you soon.